tackling the group that calls itself the Islamic State. Today, Thursday, August 21st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Fighting the militants who killed James Foley isn't going to be easy or straightforward. The extremists are using more than weapons to advance their cause.
They are thinking about the use of social media almost like big corporations or sophisticated PR agencies.
Also, the militants are raising funds by kidnapping foreigners for ransom. The U.S. does not pay, but other governments do. This French journalist was held with Foley, yet he was released.
I'm just a journalist. It's not my role to judge, to say these people are right, these people are wrong. I just have to say that I'm quite happy to be a French because I'm here with you.
Wrestling with tough questions in the Middle East, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Our newsroom is still in shock over the execution of James Foley. Before his 2012 abduction in Syria, we had interviewed him several times, a freelance journalist covering some of the most dangerous news stories of the past few years, from Libya's revolution to Syria's civil war. His gruesome killing by Islamic State militants has sparked outrage all over the globe. Syrians are also appalled. Kusai Zakaria is a former university student from the Damascus suburb of Mu'adamiyah. The area was under siege by the Assad regime for more than a year. After he was gassed and left for dead during the chemical attacks 1 year ago today, he became an activist. Kusai is now in the United States, where he's trying to drum up support for intervention in Syria, and joins us now from Washington. What was it like, Kusai, to be in Washington and see and read the news about James Foley being executed by extremists of Islamic State?
When I first heard about it, I was shocked. I felt a lot of sadness because in Syria, as an activist, it's a crime to just publish the truth. And I felt a lot of rage, and I was so disgusted from the acts of ISIS militias when they beheaded reporter Foley. I want to express my deep, warm emotions for his family. And I don't know, I think I cannot express how bad it feels like to lose another hero who came to Syria just to publish the truth.
And there are many, many heroes in Syria just trying to survive. I mean, you lived through the gas attacks of last year. You've watched as ISIS has pushed into Iraq, spreading the conflict in Syria. The United States did not intervene with airstrikes in Syria, but they have in Iraq. How does that make you feel?
I'll be a big liar if I said that I didn't feel rage when I heard President Obama saying that he's going to act in Iraq while he did it in Syria. I felt glad for all these poor people ISIS surrounded in the mountains, and I was happy that they will get help. But I also felt very sad and disappointed to see that help only goes for few people. President Obama talked about potential genocide, and that's why he acted. While in Syria, we had a true genocide going on.
Kusai, do you feel like lawmakers in Washington are listening to you and your concerns?
To be honest with you, sir, there is a lot of amazing people, and I will say again, amazing people here in the States who showed a lot of sympathy, true sympathy, and they were dying and working hard to have real support for Syrian people since the beginning. But I know all these efforts and all these amazing people are always blocked by President Obama in person. Unfortunately, President Obama doesn't have the decency to admit that his policy towards Syria was a big failure. And I think when dictators around the world feel that there is no consequences, we will see a lot of new Assad regimes in the world and a lot of new ISIS all across the world.
So you feel Syria needs more attention. Let me ask you this final question, Kusai. Do you feel that the risks and now sacrifice made by James Foley and other journalists in Syria, has it been worth it? I mean, the numbers of dead and those who fled are so numbing. Are people paying attention to the reporting?
Guys like James Foley are true martyrs and true models for the Syrian people and for the world. And I feel their sacrifices won't be a waste because believe me, when you're living in a dark place like Syria, just saying the truth or sending the truth is something more valuable than you can imagine. I really hope that all their sacrifices someday will pay off. Dozens of true heroes, reporters, died in Syria from France, from Britain, from the United States, from all over the world, from Japan. And we really hope and pray that all their sacrifices, along with the sacrifices made by the Syrian people, will someday pay off and we will live to see the free Syria that we paid this unbelievable price of blood to have it someday.
Kusai Zakaria is Syrian. He's a former university student from outside Damascus, and he's been speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, sir.
James Foley's captors made ransom demands before they killed him. They wanted $132 million for his release. The U.S. rejects such demands, but some European nations have paid in similar cases. Nicolas Hénin is a French journalist who was also kidnapped in Syria. He was held with Foley for several months, but was eventually released. This week, Hénin gave the BBC his take on different policies.
I'm just a journalist. It's not my role to judge, to say these people are right, these people are wrong. I just have to say that I'm quite happy to be a French because I'm here with you.
How governments deal with ransom demands was also the topic of a New York Times article today. It's by Rukmini Kalimaki. She says it's unclear when the Islamic State militants who held Foley first made their demands.
Foley, as you know, was held for close to 2 years, and his family did not have any contact with the kidnappers for a very long stretch. I think close to a year. So I don't believe it was that long ago that they asked for this amount of money. And then, of course, with the start of the airstrikes, and perhaps with the realization that America really would not pay, we saw the horrible end to this young man's life.
Did the Foley family want to pay the ransom?
I've not spoken to the Foley family about it. I just know from people that have spoken to them that, of course, they wanted to do everything possible to save their son's life.
There is a big inconsistency in the way Western governments deal with kidnappings and specifically the paying of ransom. Very troubling fact that a lot of European countries will pay ransom and like the U.S. will not pay a ransom. How does that all break down?
Exactly. In a story that I did earlier this month, we revealed that $125 million in ransom payments have been paid to Al-Qaeda and its direct affiliates. So although every country in the world says that they don't pay, the reality is that, in fact, it's really only the British government, the U.S. government, the Canadians, and a few small European nations that, in fact, don't pay. Others say that they do not pay, but they do behind closed doors through proxies and through intermediaries, through a system that allows them to essentially deny that they ever paid.
So two Spanish and four French journalists were being held with James Foley. They were released in March. Who paid what in those cases to get them released, you know?
I do know. Unfortunately, that's still material that remains very sensitive right now. So I'm not going to answer that question for now.
So can you answer whether it was the governments of those countries, and do they admit that they paid the money?
Of course not. Of course not. They always denied that a ransom was paid. We are in touch with some of the people that the kidnappers contacted in Turkey and in Syria in order to try to negotiate the movement of the money. So we know that these discussions were ongoing. We know that government representatives showed up, not just from Spain and France, but also from other nations whose citizens were being held. We know that these terror groups do not release Westerners without having some of their demands met. They don't do charity work.
So what do the French and Spanish governments, for example, actually say? I mean, how do they explain this? Because often there are government representatives. I've seen these pictures when these journalists get off the plane to greet them. How do they explain this?
They always deny that a ransom was paid. They punt the question to their media office, which issues, you know, a standard rebuttal of any claims that money was exchanged. I was able to go to Germany, and I spoke to some of the German officials who were literally involved in carrying suitcases of cash to North Africa in order to win the release of hostages who were held by a precursor to AQIM in 2003.
And AQIM is Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. That's West Africa.
Yet when you call the German Foreign Ministry, even though I have spoken to the very people who were involved in the money transfer, the Foreign Ministry will still tell you no ransom was paid. That payment, we know, was camouflaged as an aid payment to the nation of Mali. So they sent the payment, the suitcases of cash, to Mali. The Malian president received that money, and he then parceled it out to couriers who brought it to the terrorists, who then released the hostages. So on paper, it looks as if Germany made a payment to Mali for humanitarian aid, which is not outside the realm of imagination.
Rukmini Kalimaki, a reporter with The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the many disturbing aspects of James Foley's execution is that it was part of a deliberate PR strategy on the part of his killers. They're pretty savvy when it comes to social media, and that's thanks in part to one specific group of recruits.
We're talking about round about 2,500 people who have gone to Syria as foreign fighters over the past 3 years and who come from Western countries, that is Western Europe, North America, and Australia.
Peter Neumann is a professor at King's College London. He helped put together a detailed study about how these foreign fighters operate on social media. Most of them, Neumann says, have joined up with the Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra, two of the most brutal extremist groups in the region.
Some of the Westerners who have turned up in Syria, now in Iraq, are people who have experience with web editing, with video production. And for them, the use of social media, whether it is Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, any of these platforms, is something that they've grown up with. It is completely normal to them. And they are often maintaining their social media presence even whilst they are fighters in Syria.
So what kind of things are you looking for in their social media interactions?
They are using social media for all kinds of things. So they are posting pictures. They are having debates about issues that are of interest to them. They are, of course, reaching out to folks at home. And that is perhaps the most problematic aspect of their social media use, because they are speaking to wannabe foreign fighters who are still in Western countries. And they are reaching out to them, not sort of recruiting them aggressively, but they are there to answer questions, they are there to explain the logistics, and they are making it easier for wannabe foreign fighters to come to Syria or to Iraq and become fighters themselves. And of course, they are also involved in producing propaganda videos, in packaging messages in European languages that are also being put out there on the internet.
We think of the video of the beheading of James Foley, and that's obviously barbaric, but it's also propaganda. Would you describe the media strategy of, you know, like the Islamic State? Is it sophisticated?
It is incredibly sophisticated, and you can see in every message they put out the ultimate objective behind it. They are very disciplined in terms of the publications they put out. The Foley video, for example, was very clearly aimed at an American audience. I think that's why they picked a British speaker. They wanted to have an English speaker so it would be picked up by American media, because they know that if there's not an English speaker, there's no chance that those clips would be used on American media reports. We also see a lot of publications that are published by them that are very well designed, very well produced, and that are very disciplined again in their message. So right now, for example, a lot of the messaging that comes out from ISIS is aimed at persuading, convincing young Westerners to come to Syria and to Iraq to help build the Islamic State. For them, that's a really inspirational message. They are saying, you can be part of something fantastic or something historical, something that people in 1,000 years will be talking about, because we're creating the new caliphate. Come and be part of it.
Do you have any sense if the governments of the UK and the US might be ready to launch some kind of cyber counteroffensive against these guys?
Various governments have tried things. So the US State Department, for example, runs a Twitter campaign called Think Again, which is taking on jihadist preachers, including people that are inspiring foreign fighters on Twitter. But I have to say that these campaigns often are not as sophisticated as the jihadists.
How is that possible?
I don't know. I've been asking the government people, and at every conference I've been to, they are saying, we're working on it. We're working on a new strategy. I think that there is a thing about governments, because they want to be very careful. But the whole thing about social media is that you do not get attention unless you're doing risky things. So the US State Department or the US Department of Defense, in order to be on Twitter, every tweet has to be approved by 20 people. But that's not how Twitter works. You sometimes have to do risky things and you have to get yourself out there. But they are not quite ready to embrace social media for what it is.
Peter Neumann, professor at King's College London, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still ahead, she's a woman of color from Trinidad, lives in Ferguson, Missouri, and you'll hear her thoughts on the violence there later on The World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Life Imitates Art in South Africa. The life part involves intrigue, betrayal, scandal, and of course money. Funny, those happen to be the same ingredients that make Generations, South Africa's most popular TV soap opera. The plot for this soapy, as they call it there, is set inside an ad agency, so there's a hint of Mad Men about it.
I'm starting my own company. Now, if you want in, the time is now. Well, okay, nobody said if you want to be somebody else's slave, or you can come with me and get a slice of your own pie.
Generations commands a big slice of the ratings pie in South Africa. More than 7 million people tune in religiously to watch it. And the 16 main characters on the soap are all household names. But here's the plot twist that the actors and fans did not see coming. The entire cast was fired this week. Andile Ndlovu is an entertainment reporter with the Times of South Africa. He's in Johannesburg. Andile, drama within the drama. How'd this all happen?
A big surprise to everybody, I can tell you that. There have been murmurs for a while now that there were issues within the production. The actors very unhappy with the fact that their demands have so far been reduced to pettiness.
What are these issues they're upset about?
I think something similar to what happened with the Big Bang Theory up there in the States, where the principal cast are saying that we are responsible for the show being the top show in the country with the biggest ratings, the best ratings, big advertising coming in as well, and we should get a bigger piece of the pie. And also, because of the fact that the actors spend so much time on set, they find it very difficult to secure other jobs. And so they want to tie down the production to 3-year contract so that, a bit of stability can be achieved. And what the production has said is, no, that is not going to happen. The stories that you guys want to be put on a similar pay scale as the other soapies in this country is ridiculous, because you happen to be some of the best paid stars in the country. And they're saying that's not true.
What is the truth? Are they well paid compared to other soap stars?
Well, you know what? The truth is nobody is well paid in the local TV industry. But Generations actors do get slightly better pay. Their rates are a little better than everybody else.
The thing is, with the Big Bang Theory, the show on CBS, they pushed for a pay raise and they got it. So that was not the conclusion to the push by the Generations cast. Far from it. They must have been shocked.
I think everyone was shocked. I mean, the story's become quite political now because a few politicians have got involved and have pushed the public broadcaster to find a resolution, amicable resolution. Even the sports minister here has pushed the arts and culture minister to get involved and try and find a resolution.
One of the things that we can say as a universal truth is that soap opera fans everywhere around the world are rabid fans. How are they taking this?
My mom is a big fan. She called me in yesterday and said, what's going on? You should have the inside story to this. And how long do we have until the show is off screen? The show, obviously, like any other soap, shoots in advance. And so they've got about 6 or 7 weeks of episodes in the can. But it's weird in the sense that the younger people who, I guess, are exposed to international shows like The Good Wife and Scandal and Game of Thrones, they're not too fussed about it. But the older generation of viewers are pretty miffed.
Well, for everyone's sake, especially your mother's, I hope they get it all sorted out.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it's become part of our lives, I guess. I mean, 8 p.m. to 8:30 is the time where everyone's just sort of huddled around the television and watching Generations.
Andile Ndlovu, entertainment reporter with the Times of South Africa. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Maybe the producers of Generations will come up with some clever way to explain the cast's disappearance. One plot solution that's probably not being considered, a coral death spiral. Yeah, coral death spiral. That's what our next story is about, but there is a silver lining, and it involves fish, algae, and smell. Here's the world's Ari Daniel.
Go snorkeling off the coast of Fiji in the South Pacific, and a gorgeous coral reef swims into view, full of color, sound, and texture. This video of the reef shows big bouldery corals, branching spiky corals, and fish darting around every bend.
There's a lot of space for things to hide in, and there's a huge amount of biodiversity there.
Danielle Dixon is a coral reef ecologist at Georgia Tech. The video cuts to another patch of coral, but this time it's eerily quiet. None of the pops and crackles from before. A field of sand and coral rubble is broken up by brown seaweed, a kind of algae waving in the current.
Extremely degraded there's hardly any coral. A lot of the fish just aren't there.
The two places look worlds apart, but they're right next to each other, two halves of the same ecosystem. Here's the difference. That bustling, vibrant side, it's part of a marine protected area where fishing is banned. On the other side, fishing's allowed. Like so many corals around the world, the health of this reef is closely tied to the fish that live on and in it. That algae on the degraded part of the reef, normally there are fish that eat it and keep it in check. When fishing shifts that balance, though, the algae can start to take over and destroy the corals. Georgia Tech ecologist Mark Hay calls it part of the coral reef death spiral.
Everything that's going on, global warming, overfishing, pollution, means there's less corals, more algae, and more contact between corals and algae.
Hay and his colleagues have been documenting just how bad that contact can be.
Some seaweeds, within 2 days, those corals, they start bleaching and tissue starts dying where they're in contact. And then on a couple of those corals, that bleaching just spreads around the rest of the coral.
But the researchers have found an interesting twist to the story. In a healthier ecosystem, when the algae start to grow, corals communicate with a group of tiny saviors.
There are these small little fish called gobies. The coral releases some kind of chemical that the goby responds to within about 5 minutes.
This is Danielle Dixon again. She says it's a chemical distress call, a smell that wafts out through the water to beckon the gobies to come eat the expanding algae. Dixon's found that smells are a big part of life on these reefs. For instance, some fish born in the open ocean use smell to find corals to settle on as adults.
When you're in the open ocean, there's actually very little to orient yourself to. It's just vast blue water. And if coral reef fish are able to find the smell of coral in the ocean, they follow that home, like a yellow brick road.
Unfortunately, though, it works the other way around, too. Fish are lured by the smells of healthy reefs, but they're repelled by the smells of unhealthy ones, and that can help lock in that coral reef death spiral. The results of this research are published in today's issue of the journal Science. The details are new, but the general principle of how life tends to converse, not so much, says Mark Hay.
Most organisms don't have eyes, don't have ears, and so they decide whether to eat something next to them or run from it or mate with it, based totally on chemistry alone. And that's a world that we're pretty much blind to.
But we're slowly starting to see, or smell, that world. And this new understanding may do more than just turn up another reason that coral reefs are in trouble. The Georgia Tech ecologists say what they've learned may make it possible to help revive degraded reefs around the world by finding ways to suppress the bad smells and enhance the good ones. And so maybe we'll be able to respond to the coral reef's distress call too. For the world, I'm Ari Daniel.
Ari's story comes to us with help from the series Small Matters. We have pictures of what good corals look like at PRI.org. News headlines are coming next here on The World. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Israelis who oppose their government's policy in Gaza are having a tough summer.
I love my country. I love the people. I love the land. But this is it's a very frightening time.
I lost my job because people don't accept other people's opinion.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. To really understand a story, it always helps to get personal. That's what we're doing this week with the immigration story of the summer, the wave of thousands of unaccompanied minors from Central America headed north to the U.S. border. Yesterday, we heard how two young boys from El Salvador made that harrowing journey. They eventually reunited with their parents here, but thousands of kids are detained and sent to shelters in different parts of the U.S., and there are concerns about conditions at these facilities. The World's Monica Campbell has a story of one boy and his family. We're not using their real names to protect their privacy.
He's 11 years old, and we'll call him Carlos. For years, he and his sister lived with relatives in Guatemala, while their mom supported them from Atlanta as a house cleaner. Then, the relatives Carlos lived with were murdered in a robbery. So, last November, his mom paid for a smuggler to bring Carlos and his sister to Atlanta. They got to the Texas border, but then the smuggler ditched the kids and Border Patrol caught them.
Si nos decían de dónde éramos, pues nosotros le contestábamos que de Guatemala.
Carlos said he was from Guatemala, and he gave the officers his mom's number.
Me hablaron de la frontera que si era la madre de dos niños.
Carlos's mom says the officials called and said her kids would be sent to a shelter in New York until they could be reunited with her.
Pues está feliz porque íbamos a ir con nuestra mamá.
Carlos says he was happy because he thought he was going to see his mom. But not quite yet. They were taken to a residential detention facility called Children's Village, about 30 minutes outside New York City. And he was placed in a room with older boys, 17-year-olds, he says. It's unclear who they were, Central Americans caught at the border or youth with behavioral problems. What's clear is that one evening, Carlos says one of the older boys sexually assaulted him. Carlos fought him off and cried out, and shelter workers came and took him to a hospital. The next morning, Carlos's mom says shelter officials called her. They told her there'd been an incident with a boy at the shelter, and that Carlos would fly to Atlanta the next day. She says they told her he'd arrive with records detailing what happened, but Carlos didn't have any paperwork with him when he got off the plane. She took him to a hospital to be examined. That doctor's report states that Carlos was sexually assaulted. Since then, Carlos's mom says she's entered a black hole trying to find out exactly what happened to her son. She says officials told her there was a police report, but so far she's only received one piece of paperwork, a bill for $800. It's from the New York hospital that examined her son the night of the assault. Immigration advocates say shelters are generally safe, but stories like this raise serious concerns. Michelle Brené is with the Women's Refugee Commission in Washington.
There's been very little oversight and monitoring of these facilities, and these children have really no access to the outside world.
Children's Village directed my calls to the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees these shelters. A spokesman wouldn't comment on any policy about placing children of different ages in the same room. He also wouldn't comment on what information parents should receive when their children allege abuse. Yet he did state that HHS is working to clarify what steps should be followed in this type of case. Michelle Brené says the vague reporting requirements make it hard to know how many abuses like this happen.
I'm certain that there are many cases that we never hear about. There has to be a way to make sure that these cases aren't hidden away.
And Carlos's mom says people like her, without papers, can be afraid to speak up.
Callamos tantas cosas, tuve miedo al principio de...
But she's moving on the case and has two lawyers in Atlanta helping her pro bono. One to investigate the crime at the shelter. The other is Dustin Baxter, an immigration lawyer. He's having a hard time getting information from the shelter.
They have not been helpful at all, which just makes us all the more suspicious that something is going on to try and cover this up so that it doesn't see the light of day.
He's going to try and get Carlos a U visa. It's granted to immigrants who are victims of rape and other crimes. It could give Carlos and his family legal status since they are his caretakers. So now the family waits. Carlos's mom says it's all in the hands of God. When I visit Carlos at his new home in Atlanta, he's outside with his mom and their puppies. Carlos says he's enjoying life here. He likes school, and he's met another kid from Central America. He's also seeing a psychologist. So is his mom. She feels incredibly guilty about what's happened and hopes that now, with the family all together here, they can start over. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Atlanta.
Every immigrant has his or her own story, but I think it's fair to say most come in search of a nice place to build a good life. That's what Rufina Farrokh Unkelsaria had in mind more than a decade ago when she emigrated to the U.S. from Trinidad. She chose Ferguson, Missouri.
It has been a shock to me. I could not believe that this small, sleepy town, which I chose because of its diverse nature to live here, has become a hotbed of unrest as it has become.
Rufina lives just blocks away from West Florissant Avenue, where much of the violence has erupted over the past 2 weeks. I reached her today at the Corner Coffee House in Ferguson. Rufina's been spending a lot of time there volunteering lately.
We are distributing T-shirts that say, I love Ferguson, and we are also distributing yard signs that say, I love Ferguson as well to our residents. It's a beehive of activity here.
Are you in solidarity with the protesters or with the police, or what's kind of your position, if I can ask?
My position is I'm in solidarity with my entire community. This is small town USA, Ferguson is, and this could have happened in any community. It happened to be in ours.
And the good of the community of Ferguson has not been exactly evident in the last couple of weeks. What have your own feelings been as you've watched these protests and violence erupt in recent days?
First of all, I'm saddened by the death of the victim. I'm also sad for the officer involved. He's a young man, and in any circumstance, without thinking about the colors involved, just two human beings involved, it's a sad situation. I am an Indian.
Asian subcontinent.
Yes. Yeah. If you could see me, I have long hair and I wear Indian clothing as well, Indian traditional clothing. And I wear lots of jewelry as many Indian women do. I have to tell you that as an Indian woman in Ferguson, I have been very comfortable. I walk around even today, now, even during the last few days, wearing all of my jewelry, not feeling unsafe. Our community is a safe community. I cannot believe this one incident would mar the image of our beautiful city. I want people to know this is not what Ferguson is. Isolated incident.
How do you explain what's been going on then?
Well, like I said, Marco, this could have happened in any other town in the United States. I come from Trinidad and Tobago. This is the most southern of the Caribbean islands. Half of our population there is African and half is Indian. And of course, we have a mixing of the two as well. But there is not a great dichotomy of the two as you have here in the United States. When I moved here, I had to get used to the fact that there are two distinct cultures coexisting here, where you have African American and other. But in my country, in my home country, in Trinidad, there is an integration which I do not see here. It's not as evident here. For example, you even have the term African American. Why I don't understand why don't you just have American? As in Trinidad, we are all Trinidadians. We don't have African Trinidadians or Indian Trinidadians. We are all Trinidadians. But I find as a result, the tensions between the two are more evident here in the United States, not in Ferguson, but in any part of the United States you go, you would find this divide. It just so happened that incident sparked what is already existing all over the United States. This is not only in Ferguson. This can happen anywhere else. If you think, Marco, truthfully, put this same incident in any other town, it can happen.
Rufina Farrokh Unkelsaria immigrated to Ferguson from Trinidad more than a decade ago. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Emotions are raw as well these days in Israel. The air war between Israel and Gaza has been fueling another conflict in the country between those who support the Israeli military operation and those who oppose it. The tensions can be seen on Facebook and felt at dinner tables and workplace water coolers. One young Israeli couple near Jerusalem have their own story about how the war has affected their personal lives. They spoke with reporter Daniel Estrin.
My name is Guy, and I'm a teacher. As usual, I was active, I was giving my opinion in Facebook, and I went to a demonstration in Tel Aviv against the war, and I feel that we can solve this situation in a very different way, in a diplomatic way. One day I went to YouTube and I saw this Israeli kid refusing to go to the army. He said that, that he doesn't think that war or army effort would bring any solution. I thought it was really smart and brave what he did. So I put this YouTube on Facebook. One of my relatives told me on Facebook that I should go to Gaza and get killed there. Another one told me that I should get hit by a stone and change my views. My cousin told me that I'm crazy and that I got my grandmother upset very much and she's angry at me. I did call to my grandmother. I didn't want to make her upset. And she told me that she can't sleep at night because of me. She said there is no way of peace ever between us and the Arabs around us and I should give this idea up. I started answering and I told her, look, Grandma, you are the old generation, and I respect what you've gone through, and you have no hope of the future in Israel between the Jews and Arabs. But how can you be angry at me that I believe in peace? How can you be angry at me that I still have hope that one day my kids would not have to go to the army every 2 years and murder children, or get murdered or killed by themselves? I need to have this hope. I went to visit my family and my mother was very upset. She told me that I can't go on with it anymore. If I want to get married, no one would come to my wedding and that they all think I'm a traitor. The next part of the story is that I deleted my family, most of them, from my Facebook. It's very much a shame. It feels like the wrong thing to do.
Hi, my name is Liron. I'm a kindergarten teacher in the Jerusalem area. I'm not using my real name because I'm afraid for the consequences to my career due to this story. A day after Guy went to the demonstration, I went to work and I talked to my assistant about the violence that Guy told me that happened in the demonstration. And she told me, yes, I know, I heard it on the news. She was very okay with it. And I asked her, do you think that it is okay to behave in a violent way towards people that express different opinions? And she said, well, when it comes to soldiers, then yes, it's okay to hit people who speak against soldiers. And I know that the demonstration was not about the soldiers.
No,
was not against the soldiers.
Definitely not.
So at that point I understood that the subject of the conversation is very explosive. And I stopped. I get a phone call from the manager telling me, I forgot to tell you that I'm splitting your kids in the kindergarten to two different kindergartens because it's a small group now. And she said that from this day and on, you shouldn't come to work anymore. She never told me the reason why she's firing me, but I have no doubt that it's because of this. I lost my job because people don't accept other people's opinion.
I love my country. I love the people. I love the land. But this is crazy times. My girlfriend loses her job. And that I have to disconnect my family from my Facebook. It's a very frightening time.
I experience Israel as a place that you can place a different opinion and you can talk about different things. But lately, during the war, it just wasn't possible.
An Israeli couple grappling with how to express their opposition to Israel's actions in Gaza. They spoke with Daniel Estrin. Tomorrow we're going to meet a magician performing on the streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts. His name's Makoto, which he got from his Japanese grandmother.
I lie for money. You know, magicians are inherently deceptive, and my name means honesty, so it's a neat name to have.
Tune in tomorrow for some street magic and radio magic. You're with The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. As an American, I've always been curious about the details of how my family ended up here. For me, on my mother's side of the family anyway, and for many of you, our American story began with the violent upheavals of World War II. And yes, history is a series of connected events, but that process of displacement and flight from the war could be said to have started 75 years ago this week, and it's a part of history that many don't remember. August 23rd, 1939, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union signed a secret pact to carve up Eastern Europe. What? Yeah, I know. I thought the Soviet Union was always on the side of the Allies. Right after that secret pact, Germany invaded Poland, triggering World War II. Historian Roger Morehouse has a new book on this little-known chapter of history, The Devil's Alliance, and he joins us from London. So back to that question, Mr. Morehouse, I thought the Soviets were on our side against Germany.
That's a common misconception. We have a very enduring image and idea of the overarching story of World War II is one of the Grand Alliance, is of the British, the Americans, and good old Uncle Joe Stalin, all as allies together in defeating Nazi Germany. And that's certainly true from 1941 onwards, from Hitler's attack on Stalin in June 41. But prior to that, as you say, is very underknown, I would suggest, the fact that Stalin was actually, to all intents and purposes, an ally of Hitler's.
Right. So what were the terms of this deal, this pact that was signed this coming Saturday, now 75 years ago?
Well, I should probably just correct your introduction. The pact itself wasn't secret. The pact was publicised at the time. It was a massive shock to the outside world, not least to a generation of Nazis and communists who had spent the previous 10 years or so insulting each other. What was most unusual and was secret was the secret protocol that accompanied that pact. And that secret protocol contained, as you suggested earlier on, the details of what would happen, who would get what, in the great divvy up of Eastern Europe, in the event of, as the text put it, in the event of a territorial rearrangement. And that, of course, is code for war. So as soon as the war starts on the 1st of September 1939, the Germans obviously invade Poland from the west. That's the story that we all know. What's much less well known is that the Soviets invaded Poland from the east 17 days later on the 17th of September. And the two invading nations occupy and divide Poland between them. And that's the opening act of that relationship between them.
So this deal was critical for Hitler, I mean, to be able to invade Poland. And it really kind of shows how World War II could have taken a completely different course or maybe never have happened at all. Is that too much to say?
I think some sort of general conflagration was inevitable by this point. Hitler was increasingly bold, increasingly aggressive. Something monumental was going to happen with Hitler. He wasn't going to go quietly. It's just the manner in which it was going to happen. And actually this, the Nazi-Soviet pact as the sort of kickoff for World War II is actually almost the most surprising scenario that anyone could have imagined. That's how you have to view it from the perspective of August 1939. The world was absolutely dumbstruck by this deal.
When did Stalin wake up and realize that he probably should not have signed that pact?
I argue that he actually didn't, really. The traditional interpretation of Soviet intentions was that for Stalin it was purely defensive, that he was holding Hitler off, buying Hitler's quiescence so that he had time to rearm, to better face what we would see as the inevitable attack. Now, that's really, I think, reading history backwards. It's also the narrative that Stalin gave us after 1941. It's rather fictitious. I think Soviet thinking is actually much more aggressive than we traditionally understand.
I started this interview by talking about the displacement of people. How soon did that start after the pact was signed?
That starts very, very quickly. Obviously, Poland is invaded from the west, as I said, on the 1st of September by the Germans. That sets off massive amounts of refugees. The Soviets invade on the 17th of September. That sets off another wave of refugees in the east. When Poland is finally subdued by the two sides, which is in early October, there's a sort of brief settling down, and then you have the occupation regimes are set up in both areas. They are accompanied by a sort of general sifting of the population on both sides. Actually, the regimes have very, very similar ways of dealing with the population. There's a general sifting through to find people who might be oppositional. After that, there's a sort of a much more of a class action, if you like, where they pick up entire classes of people who have actually done nothing but are deemed to be guilty by dint of who or what they are.
And that process is basically arresting people and executing them?
Exactly, executing them. Or what the Soviets tended to prefer, as did the Germans in the initial phase, was deportation. The Soviets deported at least 1 million people from eastern Poland to Siberia, Kazakhstan and other places during that two-year period of occupation from Poland alone. And the Germans, you know, very similar figures, if not greater. So they both tended to deport rather than outright murder in that opening phase. But there's an awful lot of murdering going on as well.
We've gone through this whole interview without actually naming the pact. It was called the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact after the two foreign ministers who signed it. And we've actually been hearing a lot about Molotov cocktails in these riots in Ferguson, Missouri. Is there a connection to this
Indeed.
Molotov? What is it?
Indeed. The connection is a part of the story. As I said, the Soviet Union invaded Poland in 1939, also invaded or occupied the Baltic states and the Romanian province of Bessarabia in 1940. That was all a deal done with Hitler in 1939. Another part of that expansion was to try and push the Finnish border back. And that resulted in a very short but very nasty war in the winter of 1939-40, which is known as the Winter War. During the Winter War, the gallant Finns, who had very little in the way of armour and howitzers and the rest of it, took on the might of the Red Army in the snow and minus 30 degrees. It's an absolutely fascinating story that I would urge your listeners to read up on themselves. But one of the aspects that the Finns were very good at was improvisation. And their famous weapon that they developed at that time was the petrol bomb. And they christened it a Molotov cocktail because the propaganda that was coming from the Kremlin from Molotov's own lips was that Russian or Soviet aggression was not actually military in nature, it was humanitarian. And they said that the troops were just coming in and the aircraft were dropping food parcels to the Finns. This is an absolute fiction, but this is what the Soviets were saying. So, ironically, the Finns christened their petrol bombs Molotov cocktails as a drink to go with the food parcels. So that's where your Molotov cocktail comes from.
Well, listeners can read about that fascinating episode in your book, The Devil's Alliance, which will be on sale here in the U.S. in October. Historian Roger Morehouse, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We'll leave you today with a song that Stalin himself might have sung if Germany had not turned against him. From their latest CD, here's jazz orchestra Pink Martini featuring the Von Trapps, the grandchildren of the Sound of Music family, and the classic Die Dorfmusik from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you tomorrow. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.